Actually, they have another term for me. It's not Dean. It's the has-been Dean. I stepped down from that, actually, 2001 or 2002. So they add the little tag emeritus to make sure that you don't confuse me with the Dean. And I've been the editor of this particular journal since 2004. And I came in as a reluctant draftee, but I thoroughly enjoy it, and it's really hard for me to even contemplate stepping down from it in a year or two. I wanted to I'm sort of guessing what it is that people here would be interested in, and I think that's tough. I always find it hard when I'm teaching students and I don't know what their expectations are or what their background is. So let me just take a chance. I want to just give you two perspectives that I have that are quite central to my belief system. And one of them is that patient care advances, healthcare advances for patients, actually comes in large part from discoveries. And I use discoveries as a very broad term and not just formal research. And then the other belief I have, which is strong and probably gotten stronger the last 8 or 10 years, is that the journals, their authors, and the reviewers, and even sometimes the editors, play a pretty central role in advancing patient care through discovery. So those are sort of premises I have. Now the commercial side of it. What is optometry and vision science? It's in the 56 or so ophthalmology category when Thompson's ISI does its calculations. And right now we're pleased to rank in the top 20 of those 56 top international journals in eye, vision, optometry, and ophthalmology. Just to give you an idea of our size, we're not that huge, but I've been looking up some other journals and realised that we're not small either. We have published last year about 181, meaning 2011, 181 manuscripts, which I think is quite a lot for this field. We have an acceptance rate that's probably hovering around 40 to 45%. And we like to say when we're sending our logo out that we are the leading optometry journal worldwide. And that's emphasizing optometry. We are, in fact, on impact factor at least, ranked at the top of the international optometry journals. So right, what I want to do in the next few minutes, like 10 minutes or so, right, is give you some quick comments on the scope and the content of OVS's publications, what the submission and review process is for us, which is pretty standard, the average times for review, authors always like to know that, and the time to first decision, which is quite important, and many journals do describe themselves in terms of that decision, and you'll see in a moment why. The ideal submission, and also some of the pitfalls for authors who wish to know a little bit ahead of time before they submit. And then there's some recent, for me, quite exciting changes that are taking place in our journal, and I think they're taking place in a number of journals right now in terms of the digital online-only kinds of presence and the enormous amount of enrichment you get, particularly in health sciences and particularly in eye and vision, which is a motion kind of a field, that I'm excited that we're just about to take a bit advantage of. So let's just get to the scope part. Actually, it's a very broad scope. We look for original, what we call research, original articles, original papers. They're usually a result of, invariably a result of some kind of planned study that has the usual kind of background, methods, results, discussion format. We also accept reviews. Those are sometimes tougher. We're a bit more fussy about who we want reviews from. Basically, we're just not interested in the PhD's introductory chapter. A lot of journals are not. So you have to do something with it. You have to be current, you have to have something of interest, and you should really bring a point of view to a review that's somehow current. clinical cases. We used to call them case reports, but there is a range of clinical case presentations, and we've beefed that up just in the last couple of months. Technical reports, often those will come from basic science arenas where someone's come through with a new technology or a new application and it doesn't quite reach the original paper's threshold, but it's more descriptive to call it a technical report. And clinical reports, some of those are the same sort of thing, but very much more clinically based. A somewhat arbitrary distinction on those last two. What about the content? Well, I put in one word there, broad. Now, we and I and Vision don't always, we're not always thought of as being a broad category of science. But if you're in a Vision science training program like we have at Berkeley, you get all the way from bioengineers to advisors in public health to advisors in nutritional sciences to advisors in optometry and in ophthalmology and in basic bench-related eye research. So we, the content that we publish in broad terms is disorders and diseases of the eye and vision, systemic disorders where the impact on eye and vision is described. A good example is diabetes, but aging is another one. Clinical and basic eye and vision research, bench research and bedside time of research, both of those and both directions are of interest to us in this journal. And we have, not as much as we'd like, but we do have vision and eye public health and epidemiological studies that we like to publish. And in that respect, I've made a note here, we have a call for papers right now, I think it's due in early January, for papers under the title of Measuring the Patient's Perspective. So it's like quality of life instruments, but it's beyond that. And we had a very successful issue, probably our most cited issue, feature issue, was in 2007 on vision quality of life. It was just very timely because there were many people who were still using rather old, dated approaches to quality of life tools. And so we got lucky on that one. So that's that. Now, to the other points that I said I'd cover, the submission and review process. By and large, any journal will tell you, just go and look up the author instructions. But we do know that authors don't read author instructions, and especially if they've already submitted something before, they think they know, and often they do, but often they make egregious errors. The submission is an online, as most journals are nowadays. It wasn't when I came through the door in 2004. There was still handling paper, and I said, I won't take the job unless it's online. So processes like editorial manager is where people submit their papers, and it works very, very smoothly. It's tougher for older authors who are still got remnants of the paper era, and people like me, I think I struggle to get through those things because what's obvious to a younger generation is not obvious to me in terms of where you find it on the web page and where you click and so on. The editor then gets that manuscript and assigns a topical editor, TE, and the TE in turn, typically a board member, we have 10 of them, but not always. We have associate topical editors who are descriptively really occasional topical editors or guest topical editors, and they assign two or three reviewers, depending on what they're looking for. They're usually two, but sometimes three if they want backup in some area, like in the statistics aspects of the paper. They are also asked, because of the beauty of the process, to name about four others so that we never go back and bother them again, hopefully, because we just work down the list that they gave us in the orders if we get people who decline to review. Then after the reviews are in, the TE recommends a decision to me as the editor, and then the editor makes a decision. Now, the average times for that editor decision, that means you've had reviewers assigned, the reviewers have responded, and the TE has made a notation to me, is pretty good, and I think it, among some of the better journals, it's similar. It's about 33 days. And what's important for authors to know is that that first decision is pretty useful, because I would say about 80%, I haven't checked the numbers recently, of those papers that are not going to make it, they're going to get rejected, 80% of them are at that first decision stage. So authors can move on and go wherever else they want to go and try and publish their work and actually take advantage of a pretty good, typically constructive critiques. But they've been rejected by our journal. That doesn't mean they won't want to try somewhere else. The ideal submission, I didn't go to any textbook for this or previous lectures or anything else, but from my gut, it's important that the authors make the context for their contribution really quite clear, that they write well and concisely, that they immediately give the reader an opportunity to see why what they're doing is relevant, and that they actually tip us off to what the discovery part is going to be in this paper. And that's my bias. Some people wait until the very end to tell you in the discussion what the discovery is. But I noticed journals like Science used to ask you, they required you to say in a sentence or two what briefly was the important part. The background should be focused. It shouldn't be a long series of things based on all the papers that the author has read and felt they ought to try and get in there. It should be very focused on the particular issues they're studying. The methods, of course, need to be detailed enough, and the analyses, that someone could replicate this. But nowadays, I think the expectation is that they could replicate it, but they probably ought to contact the author for some of the more detailed things, or go to, nowadays, an appendix that has much more detail in it that journals like to use, rather than to use up precious page space. The results should be well presented. This is a really common problem. You could have a whole course on presentation of graphs and tables and avoiding unnecessary duplication and not saying the same thing in the text that's perfectly clear in the table or the graph and so on. That's a fun topic separately, and it's worthy of reading books on. And I'll give you a reference at the end, but there are many good ones, and you'll hear more about that, I think, in this session. And then in the discussion, I think it's important that the authors clearly identify what their discovery is, and that they acknowledge what the limitations of the study were that led them to those conclusions. The common pitfalls, well, the first and obvious one is not meeting any of those things. Not having all those five bullets above. But there are other problems that I know others, maybe Kevin and our other speaker will address it too, is the way you go about as an author interacting with the reviewers and the topical editors and the editors all the way is quite important. Most people are quite human and they don't like to be insulted when they're volunteering their time as a reviewer or an editor. They're not typically paid, as you know. And being combative is probably a really ill-informed way to respond to what is intended to be constructive, but isn't always, but intended to be constructive criticism or comment. The rule I always tell with my students is do it the same way you would do a grant review, where you're responding to a critique. This is not a personal attack on you. This is meant to be constructive, or at least they're instructed to be constructive. And so be polite, but if you disagree, say why you disagree. Make your case about why that reviewer's request is not one that you are going to respond to. And be very clear in the response where in the manuscript you've made changes, so that the editors and reviewers aren't just told, look, I've made so many changes I can't really go back and detail it. Imagine yourself as a reviewer getting that kind of thing, and you've got to hunt to see where things changed in the whole paper. It's got to be line this, line that, and so on, and we do that. So those are the common pitfalls. So what's new? I want to finish up on this. For us, what's exciting to me is that we've had a chance to formally move our journal into enriching particularly the clinical content, but I think it'll expand to all aspects, the online-only opportunities. Now, online, of course, is not just online-only, but online-only is the vehicle that we're able to do it in our journal without expanding the contractual page numbers drastically, because it costs a lot less to do things online than it does on printed paper, or it used to. Now the publishers are getting smart and they've changed their business model so they know how to charge you for what they need. But what we've done in our online only is a couple of things. I've expanded just this month a section called Clinical Communications, and it's still finding its feet, but it is online only. And clinical communications is the major heading. And they come in the form so far as clinical cases, the traditional case report, clinical commentary. I look for people who want to make a point to their colleagues about things. Clinical perspective, that's if they're a bit further away out and it's not just a commentary, it's a petition to do something differently. Like we have one this month that said, we optometrists should not keep referring to 20/20 vision. Now that's pretty radical. This coming year we'll have what I call a video corner. So there's a whole lot of great stuff on YouTube and other places that are good for healthcare providers and clinicians and basic scientists and so on. And we need to be able to lead our readers towards some of those that meet certain corners. And then I think we have a submission section of that where people make videos and we do peer review on their submissions, on just the videos. And whether we have some text with it or not is something I'll have to figure out. The big thing that was announced this month for us, and for everyone for 3 months at least, without membership, without subscription, is the iPad app that we have for the journal. And that was introduced October 1, and anybody in this room, whether or not they're paying dues to the academy or not, can actually download very easily from, I think it's from iTunes, the whole issue of October, and then in a few days, the whole issue of November, and then December. And then after that, the free trial period that the publishers have given us will go underground. So now if you want to look at this journal and see the whole journal, not just download the article as you will have to do with your computer still, as I have to do, if you have an iPad, then I urge you to do that, to check it out and look at it. It's even for an old guy like me, it's possible to get to the point where it seems easy. The feature issue I mentioned, that I invite those who are in this, I think that would apply to a lot of you, measuring the patient's perspective. It'll come up quickly on us, but we've been making the call for a couple of months, and we tend to get them in the last few days of any deadline. I think most journals experience this. They'll come crashing in, and we'll just be overwhelmed, and we'll smile all the way. That's being led by Konrad Pasudos, who was one of the pioneers in quality of life instruments that is now in Australia. But he's agreed to lead that. He's got three internationally well-known people on as guest editors with him. We also are doing a myopia issue, and I know some of you in this room are interested. Myopia is always a hot topic in optometry and ophthalmology, and especially so in the last 10 years or so. This last year we did a whole 300-page hard copy version of imaging in ophthalmology and optometry, and I thoroughly recommend that to anyone who's interested in the technology of imaging advances. And we did one just last month on entirely dedicated to low vision working with patients, low vision technologically. There's some exciting things going on in low vision, even including things like retinal implants and the bionic eye and so on. We're still getting some of that coming through, and I think that will advance at its own pace, but it's certainly a new topic for what sometimes is viewed as an old, stale topic called low vision. And then last, I want to just finish by telling you that finally I've been caught up with, and I've been promising it for years, but we will put a course on next year at our Academy meeting that's for new authors and reviewers, and make it very much a panel with illustrations and so forth, a course. And that I've committed to, and I've gotten people who are willing to help with that. And then I apologise to Mel, as having him listed here, I thought I stole this straight off your website, APHA. Of course, he's no longer president-elect. He's just finished his term. And we in optometry are very proud of his leadership there, and we congratulate him on what I assume was a very successful year. The one book, and I think it's one of many, I'm hoping Kevin and our other speaker will make comments about where you can access things, but there is a book that I only recently got hold of that Tom Lang wrote, How to Write, Publish and Present in the Health Sciences, a guide for clinicians and laboratory researchers. Now, it's my understanding that these slides will be downloaded so that APHA members can actually get at them. Is that, even though I only downloaded them about an hour ago? Okay. So I'm also happy if you chase after me at Berkeley. It's simple, aadams@berkeley.edu. So thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for giving me a chance to share some of the things that I enjoy.